In Hershey, Pennsylvania, you can't cruise past the factory on Chocolate Avenue without getting a whiff of that famous cocoa goodness. Next year, that sweet smell will be gone, along with 500 jobs. The Hershey Corporation says it's closing the historic factory and eliminating half the workforce. NPR's Jamie Terabe reports.
When Milton Hershey broke ground on this factory in 1903, he saw more than smokestacks and a brick building.
He didn't build a factory and said, oh, what do I need to do with my workers? I'll build a town. They went hand in hand and were developed simultaneously.
Pam Whitenick is head of archives at the Hershey Museum. She says Hershey wanted to give his employees more than a paycheck. He wanted to create a workers' paradise. Inspired by another famous chocolate maker of his day, Cadbury, in England, Hershey provided low-rent housing, public transportation, and a water park. A lot has changed. At Hershey World, visitors can make their own candy bars. The amusement park and other recreational activities Hershey originally built for his workers now cater to tourists. The chocolate factory is no longer the biggest employer in town. The Hershey Medical Center is. The number of workers who actually make chocolate continues to shrink.
You know, they put new equipment in that ran faster, took less people to operate. You know, it was shrinking because of that.
Dennis Bomberger first began work at Hershey in 1967. He was 18 years old and made kisses.
The new plant is going to be making them exactly the same way. It's just newer equipment.
Hershey is spending $300 million on a new facility being built just outside town. 600 workers from the old factory will move there. The rest are being replaced by machinery. Hershey's reshaping itself to fend off global competition. It has a huge new competitor in Kraft, which recently bought Cadbury. Bomberger understands why the historic factory has to close. It's old and can't accommodate new equipment.
The ceilings are low and they do have a lot of columns in there that they'd have to go around.
Standing near a ticket counter at Hershey World, company spokesman Kirk Seville says Hershey is doing this to stay competitive.
We're creating a cost-effective, efficient facility that will enable us to compete with global players and meet the needs of customers and our consumers.
Hershey had wanted to move production out of the Pennsylvania town altogether, but decided to keep it here when the union agreed to the job cuts. That small consolation to some workers. Here at the Parkside Grill, the mood is one of uncertainty. It's still unclear who'll stay and who'll lose their jobs. There's already been one round of voluntary buyouts. Bob Laird is a local businessman whose fiancée works at the Hershey factory.
I hate to say it, but I think Milton's probably turned it over in his grave, saying things that have happened in the last few years.
Laird sees the factory closure and job cuts as a sign of corporate greed and says it's a rejection of Milton Hershey's original vision of providing for his workers. Author Michael D'Antonio disagrees.
Oh, poor Milton Hershey has been turning in his grave so many times since he died that I imagine he's quite worn out. You know, he understood that all things change.
D'Antonio, who's written a book about Milton Hershey, says the legendary confectioner was, after all, a businessman and made decisions based on the market and the bottom line. Jamie Tarabe, NPR News.
Here's another way to measure the state of the economy. The median household income is down 5% from its peak in 1999. It's just under $50,000, meaning half of American households make less than $50,000. Today, we begin a series of profiles of Americans living in the middle, right around that $50,000 mark. NPR's Tovia Smith has been talking with a family in New Hampshire.
Sue Spencer says she's always known what she wanted to do when she grew up. She wanted to take care of people.
Hi, Ann.
Hi.
How have you been?
Not too good.
Now, 25 years into a career in social services, Spencer is still passionate about helping the elderly.
The breathing is very bad.
Well, this air is horrible.
I know, but I have my air conditioner.
I know just the person that can answer this question, so I'll ask her.
I love what I do. I'm a case manager to the core. It makes me feel good. But, you know, I do regret that somewhere along the way somebody said, here's how your job is valued, the pay that went with my position.
Spencer makes about $42,000 a year. She also works overnights with disabled adults for an extra $4,000, and with a few thousand in child support, it's doable in a perfect month, she says. But most months are not perfect.
It's always juggling, you know who you can pay late and who you absolutely can't.
Something as small as school pictures or a broken washing machine can keep her up at night.
I will literally take out pen and paper and go, what's flexible in the budget? Food is flexible.
Spencer is not one to whine, as she puts it, perhaps because she's known better and she's known worse. Back in the 90s, with a husband working as a carpenter, things were great, she says. But everything changed when he suddenly walked out and Spencer ended up on public assistance.
I went from, you know, helping my clients apply to Medicaid to being there as a parent and experiencing the woman on the other end of the glass, you know, not even looking up. Brutal, brutal.
Her rock bottom was one day when her two girls, Katie and Galen, who were 9 and 4, saw their mom in tears.
We were sitting out by the lake and Katie says to me, we need Indian names, Mom. You'd be standing tall, and I'll be running brave, and Galen will be little one. Okay, Mom? And I came home that night, and I was just going, you know, I just need to be that person.
Newly determined and newly promoted at work, Spencer managed to get off public assistance and even buy a house by working overtime and watching every penny. She wears prescription eyeglasses she found online for $8. She gave up her phone line at home and just uses her cell. And her daughters, who've been working since their first paper routes, are used to making do, like Galen did last spring with a prom dress from a thrift store. On good days, Spencer says, she sees it as character building.
But it's good for them to see, you know. It doesn't come to you. But, you know, I have my moments at 3 a.m. where I don't always look at it that way. I'll be honest with you.
Spencer says she especially sweats the big stuff, like sending 2 kids to college.
Well, you really like this one?
Yeah, my favorite.
Your favorite over UNH?
In the kitchen after school, Spencer pours through a pile of brochures she and Galen collected at a college fair.
No, I know. I mean, the cheapest school is probably UNH, and that's what...
Well, that's my second favorite, which is good.
Spencer nods silently. This is a tricky thing for her, encouraging Galen to follow her dreams, even if it means she'll graduate with a huge load of debt hanging over her head.
You'd live in a smaller apartment, and you'd make car payments, and, you know, you do what your mom's done, you know, all of her life, and you do what makes you happy. But you don't want your kids to struggle.
The Spencer girls know better than most what it means to struggle, and they're both driven because of it. But they've also seen how even the best laid plans can crumble, and that's taught them to let go a little, too.
I feel like it'll come and we'll figure it out. Like, it's life, like, you can't really plan it.
That's just how it is, you know? We do everything we can, and then the rest of this is out of our hands, just like it always is. And then we sort of hope and pray for the best.
Tovia Smith, NPR News.
We're in a country where just about everybody thinks they're middle class. If you're not sure you know what middle class means, you can test your knowledge at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. We're looking this morning at the way the tough economy has hit different groups across America. In a moment, we begin a series we call Living in the Middle, about how middle-class Americans are coping.
First, we're going to hear how older Americans are faring. Many have been pushed into unwanted retirement. And yet a new study finds more Americans now expect to work well past retirement age. NPR's Jennifer Ludden has that story.
For some, a return to the workplace is a choice. When Cass Clark retired after decades as a public school teacher, it just didn't feel right.
There were only so many thrift stores to explore and rooms to clean, and I felt like I was too young to just stay home.
Still in her 50s, Clark also missed the social interaction. So she found a part-time job with the local utilities department in Marysville, Washington, teaching school children about electricity.
It's all the fun part about teaching and none of the report cards and conferences and staff meetings. So I'm not like, oh, I have to work. It's I get to work. It's really fun.
In Alexandria, Virginia, Debbie Johnson says everyone assumed she was retiring when she left a full-time job in human resources. But a few years later, she's back to part-time consulting. She enjoys the sense of self-worth a paycheck brings. And on a more practical note, there's her family's history of longevity.
If I, in my 60s, am looking at another 30 or 40 years of expenses, then it can't hurt to earn a little more money now.
This is the new normal. Career flexibility is the new normal.
Ellen Galinsky heads the Families and Work Institute. In a new study, it finds 20% of workers 50 and over have formerly retired, then re-entered the workplace. Like both Clark and Johnson, many go back on different terms for fewer hours and like their new jobs a lot better.
They will say things like no more meetings, no more stupid politics, that I don't have to work for people I don't like. In fact, one out of every three people who is formerly working for someone else now is his or her own boss.
The study calls this a retirement job. Co-researcher Marcy Pitt-Kasufis says when she first launched the Sloan Center on Aging and Work, that term generated laughs.
Within 5 years, it went from being an oxymoron, really a contradiction in terms, to being language that we actually all understand what it means.
Pitt-Kasufis says the recession has accelerated a trend well underway. A striking 75% of older employees now say they expect to work during traditional retirement years. For some, this is no choice at all.
I'm 78 now, and I've lost control of my life more than any time ever.
Jim Platt says it wasn't supposed to be this way.
We've had a camping trailer for a million years, it seems, and looking forward to Mama and I becoming full-timers.
Platt and his wife are going to leave Utah to spend winters in the southwestern desert, summers in Big Sky country. But just when Platt was about to retire in his mid-60s, his wife got lung cancer. He ran up $35,000 in debt while caring for her. Now, at age 78, Platt is slowly paying that down by working as a school bus driver.
I've started taking extra runs on the school bus for field trips to pick up more money. I just keeping my fingers crossed. So far, I've been blessed with very, very good health.
More than half those in the Families and Work Institute poll say they returned to work so they could retire more comfortably. Nearly a fifth say they had to do it to make ends meet. In addition to paying down his debt, Platt is also raising a great-granddaughter. She's 18.
She's looking for work, and we're getting a car running for her and, you know, still playing daddy.
Unless he becomes disabled or is laid off, Jim Platt says he doesn't believe he'll ever be able to stop working. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
At the height of the global financial crisis 2 years ago, world leaders braced for a trade war. Governments were desperate to save jobs and protect their industries from foreign competition. In the end, they mostly avoided protectionism. Now there's a new danger. When finance ministers gather in Washington later this week, they'll talk about how to avert a currency war. NPR's Tom Gelton explains.
Governments around the world are disappointed their economies are recovering so slowly, and they're seeking new ways to boost growth. One option is to devalue their currencies. With their products priced more cheaply in the world market, they get an edge over their competitors. But sometimes the competitors just follow suit. The United States blames China for its low exchange rate, but Japan, Switzerland, South Korea, Taiwan, and Brazil have all taken steps recently to cheapen their currencies. When everyone devalues, the result is a currency war. There can be chaos in the world economy, even global deflation. With the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank fall meetings here this weekend, finance ministers will be urged to cooperate rather than compete on the currency front. U.S. officials are calling on the IMF to impose some badly needed discipline. The Institute of International Finance, representing the world's leading banks, this week urged governments to, quote, hammer out an understanding and let their currencies find their natural market value. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.